Hello. Well, what am I talking about today? Of course, it's Belarus. With a likely short, spur of the moment, off the top of my head, and likely also mildly incoherent look at what's going on, and more to the point, what can we do about it? Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow's shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency, and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons, who also receive extra perks and bonuses appropriate to their tier. If you'd like to join them, just head on to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. But now, on with today's programme. So, as I warned, this is going to be a bit of a rambling thoughts in progress as of the morning of Thursday, the 27th of May, of this particular crisis, some particular issues that I think are worth raising, and also, obviously, culminating in the necessary what-is-to-be-done moment in which I opine on what the great and good of the global community ought really to be doing, because, of course, they're going to listen to me. I want to start with a sort of fraught issue, which is this question of Russia's role in what went on and the forcing down by the duplicitous use of international airline rules that, let's be honest, are there to keep us all, crew and passengers alike, safe. But anyway, this was abused in order to bring down a plane so that Roman Protasevich, who is still by in some quarters sometimes rather unfairly described as blogger, again, shades of what happens to Navalny in Russian propaganda, but it really should be regarded as not just an independent journalist, but also a key figure in the informational opposition to Lukashenko's regime. Anyway, so they have him and his Russian-born girlfriend arrested. Immediately what happened is some people, of course, had to turn this into actually part of the wider West versus Russia dispute. People claiming flatly that, oh, Lukashenko wouldn't have done this without consulting with the Russians, or that actually the Belarusian state wouldn't have been capable of doing this. Which, we've got to remember, I mean, this means monitoring a single figure and then misusing air traffic control rules. I mean, it's not actually as if it was a massive and sophisticated operation in that respect. The point is this, I do not know if Russia was involved at all, if they were tipped off in advance, or whether they actually had any kind of active role. All I can say is that we do not, in my opinion, yet have the kind of information that would allow us to say, to assert so glibly that that was indeed the case. It will no doubt come if it's there. I mean, if the lessons of recent Russian misdeeds have shown us anything, it is, whether it's through Bellingcat or leaks or whatever, the truth will in due course out. That is one of the fundamental rules, I think, of the modern networked age. But at the moment, we don't. Let me just quickly go through the four main reasons that are advanced. First of all, there's this notion that Belarusian dictator Alexander Lukashenko wouldn't act without clearing it with Putin. We shouldn't forget the extent to which their relationship is a deeply problematic one. I mean, frankly, it is defined more than anything else by mutual dislike and mistrust. The problem is, obviously, at the moment, they need each other. Lukashenko needs Russian support to stay in power, given that he's near enough declared war on his own people. And the Russians are not at all interested in keeping Lukashenko in power, but what they absolutely don't want to see is another country in their self-proclaimed, self-perceived sphere of influence as falling to people power, and then, as in Ukraine, no doubt shifting its orientation toward the West. I mean, let's be honest, if Putin is thinking about his place in history, he doesn't want to be known as the Tsar who oversaw the ungathering of the Russian lands. So although in the long term, I think it's fairly, or even the medium term, frankly, it's fairly clear that Moscow would love to be able to dispense with Lukashenko and bring in someone who is a little bit less toxic, a little bit more predictable, a little bit more biddable, a little bit more loyal, for the moment they seem to be pretty much stuck with him. But as I say, there is no enthusiasm for him there. And Lukashenko himself has demonstrated that he's willing and is still able to be an independent actor. Very much it's the question of how much can they each influence the other. Secondly, this notion that a bunch of Russians were on the plane and got off at Minsk, implying that that was the security detail that was no doubt shadowing Mr. Protasevich. Well, that's actually been later on debunked. It turned out that actually it was one Greek who in any case had been heading to Minsk anyway to see his girlfriend, and the others were Belarusian, so presumably agents of the Belarusian KGB. And I still find it so interesting and significant that when the Soviet Union collapsed, the Belarusian didn't even change the damn name of their political police force and essentially took the Belarus branch of the KGB and just simply made it their own security and intelligence service. But anyway, so, you know, actually, again, that is not the smoking gun that some people eagerly pounced upon. Thirdly, some people have asserted that the KGB has no record of being able to act with autonomy outside of the country. This is flatly wrong. I mean, even before 2012, again, it was subsequently leaked, there were discussions about carrying out assassinations of irritating whistleblowers in Europe. And since then, I mean, the KGB is involved in an extremely aggressive campaign of monitoring and harassing emigre opposition figures and dissidents and so forth outside of Belarus. So the idea that they wouldn't just be able to track one specific individual and know when he gets on a plane and which plane doesn't sound at all credible. And it's also worth noting that the notion that the KGB and the Russian security apparatus, particularly the FSB, the Federal Security Service, is so carefully integrated and so chummy that, again, there's no way the Russians wouldn't have known what's going on or been able to have a veto. Well, that forgets the fact that until relatively recently, really until all these protests blew up, Lukashenko's policy had been to, as far as possible, maintain what's sometimes known as a multi-vector policy. Put rather more crudely, but also rather more accurately, he would play off Europe against Russia. He would quite artfully navigate between the two, sometimes leaning towards one, sometimes leaning towards the other, precisely to maintain his own strategic autonomy. As part of that, one of the primary functions of the KGB was precisely to keep Russian influence and agents out of Belarus. And this is one of the reasons why, in just September of last year, the former chairman of the KGB, Vakulchik, was dismissed to a large extent under Russian pressure, precisely because he had been so successful and so aggressive in carrying out this particular mission. So yes, of course, they interact pragmatically, they share information when they can, and indeed the KGB and the FSB are quite similar in terms of their mindsets. They are still essentially rather hawkish and paranoid secret police forces. But this is about two agencies that interact and share information when it is to their advantage, rather than that there's been any kind of general takeover. And finally, that's also true of the issue of Belarusian air defence. Some people have pointed to the fact that Belarusian and Russian air defence is overall integrated. Well, that's perfectly true. But that absolutely doesn't mean that President Lukashenko can't order one single MiG-29 jet in the air without clearing it with Moscow. Of course, Moscow would have heard what's going on. And this is the thing. I mean, I don't think Moscow was caught by absolute surprise as the plot unfolded. But it's this question of whether or not they actually had some more crucial role. Now, why am I hammering in on this? Well, first of all, the way that in some ways Belarus has just simply been folded into this wider conflict, to me, is something of a betrayal of Belarus itself. We need to treat it as a problem, a situation, a crisis, and an opportunity in its own right, rather than just simply how it relates to Russia. Secondly, actually, if we start to basically treat this as essentially a Russia problem rather than a Belarus problem, well, yes, to an extent, Putin does have a certain degree of moral responsibility because his support has helped keep Lukashenko in power, though I don't think for a moment that it has yet been crucial. But nonetheless, we can argue that. But in practical terms, if we start essentially sanctioning Russia as a way of punishing Belarus, which is precisely what various hawkish voices have been advocating, the result will not be, probably, to get Putin to put pressure on Lukashenko to, I don't know, to step down or just generally be more warm and fuzzy. Not at all. Actually, this will be regarded as a challenge by a Russian leader whom we know, when he feels he's facing a challenge, is aware of some of the fragilities of his situation, and also, for reasons all to do with machismo and his own personal character, feels he cannot afford not just to not back down, but not to be seen to be backing down. So if anything, it actually would require him to double down on his support for Lukashenko. So it's not just wrong in terms of accuracy, it's also, I would suggest, deeply wrong in terms of policy at the moment to see too much of a Russian connection. Now, as I say, we'll wait and see. It may well be that actually things will emerge that will demonstrate that there was a stronger Russian role. Maybe it was Russian intelligence assets that pinpointed which plane Protasevich was on, or Russians who suggested that Lukashenko might want to do this, though I doubt that. But until we have that, let's not just start assuming that Russia did it in every single case. Okay then, well, if we don't think it's because the Russians told him to, why on earth would Lukashenko have carried out this act of mingled malice and madness, it would seem? Knowing, surely, he must have known. He's a wily operator. He must have known the amount of international uproar it would create. Well, look, the first and most obvious reason is not just simply to take one guy off a plane, but to have a massively chilling effect on the wider emigre opposition and information resistance that he faces. I mean, let's be clear, without in any way disparaging the still extraordinary bravery, ingenuity, imagination and passion of ordinary Belarusians protesting in the streets, it's clear that the inspiration, the mind, the coordination, and in some ways the people who give it that clear political context in the outside world are outside Belarus these days. And I think this is what he was aiming at. He was aiming at trying to chill them. Now, of course, key people like the, you know, in effect president in exile, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, they're not going to be deterred. But there are many, many other Belarusians who might, who think that they have found safety in the outside world and have to be warned, from Lukashenko's point of view, that it doesn't matter where you are, somehow we will, even if it involves getting a plane down out of the air, somehow we will get at you. We'll have to see what kind of impact that has. I suspect things have gone too far for this really to change anything, but presumably that is a key element of what Lukashenko was thinking about. Secondly, I mean, I suspect it's also that he thought he could get away with it and that he could visit his evident anger upon someone like Protasevich. There is no doubt a degree to which people like Lukashenko soon begin to kid themselves of their impunity. And let's be perfectly honest also that the West, and above all the European Union, haven't really given him many reasons not to think that he has considerable impunity. If you think that basically you are going to be able to get away with it, that yes, maybe you're going to face some airline sanctions and so forth, but that'll be the end to it, then it could have been tempting just simply to say, to hell with it, I'm annoyed with this guy, and no one gets away with annoying me. The third, though, and perhaps, you know, maybe being too, I'm here, I'm being too smart for my own good, trying to bring too much logic into what could have been an intensely emotional decision. But I also wonder if this was Lukashenko, the ultimate manipulator, forcing Putin's hand. As I said before, there are already people who are actually saying that therefore, well, obviously Russia was involved, and therefore obviously Russia must also pay a price, and that this in turn forces Putin to back Lukashenko all the more. Because after all, this notion that the Russians would have encouraged it precisely to isolate Lukashenko and burn his bridges with the West, that just really doesn't hold true. I think Lukashenko is already as isolated as this can be. I don't think Lukashenko can walk this back. I don't think he can actually suddenly turn to the West and say, I'm sorry, I don't know what got into me. I'm actually going to sort of stop putting people in prison arbitrarily because they just simply wear red and white clothing or similar. No, let's start being friends again. That's too late for that. So actually, in that situation, his only game is now Moscow. And given that it has been clear that Russia needs to, as it were, retain Belarus in its sphere of influence, but doesn't feel that it necessarily needs to retain Lukashenko, this may well have precisely been in order to create a situation in which Putin himself feels he has to support not just Belarus, or the current Belarusian regime, rather, but Lukashenko as well, if he wants to demonstrate that he is not the kind of czar who can be dictated to by foreign powers. So, you know, this is possible. I don't know. Again, it's... On the one hand, it does sound a little bit too conspiratorial. But on the other hand, I can't help but feel there has to be some kind of bigger game if you're going to do as big a move as this. However, if we return to the issue of the chilling effect, I mean, what that also does demonstrate, or remind us of, rather, is the extent to which free media and the capacity of people with genuine public legitimacy outside the country to be able to mobilise public opinion really is a threat to the Lukashenko regime. And this is one thing that is actually, again, different from Russia. For reasons that I'm going to come back to, let me just dwell on this for a moment. I think it's hard to disagree with the contention that had the Belarusian elections been held freely and fairly, Lukashenko would likely have lost. Or at the very least, he would have been in a very, very tight race. But no, I'm not denying the possibility that he would have lost. Whereas, I mean, although one can make the case that Lukashenko stole an election, but in some ways Putin has stolen a whole political system by systematic exclusion of the opposition and so forth. And it's also very clear that when he and his political system stand for re-election, the vote is rigged. But on the other hand, I think there's little question also that Putin is, like it or not, the most popular politician in Russia still. And he would win elections at the moment. Again, look, this is not saying that he's a legitimate ruler, because obviously there has been all this distortion of the wider political system. But as it were, here and now, in Russia, however much we may dislike, even despise policies that are being enacted by the Kremlin, but nonetheless, there is a degree of legitimacy to the regime, a degree of legitimacy to the regime, which is absolutely absent in Minsk. And that says something about, obviously, the state of play, but it also says something about the options at our disposal and the whole vexed question of what is to be done. So let me take a brief break, because I need to make myself some lemon tea before embarking on the important bit, and then let's turn to that. Just the usual reminder, you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. You can support it by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter, @MarkGagliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Gagliotti on Russia. Now, back to the show. Well, welcome back, and thanks for your patience, but come on. It's 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm doing this impromptu. I need my lemon tea, and yes, there was a biscuit too. Anyway, let us turn now to this whole vexed question, the important question, though, of what is to be done. Well, obviously, the first moves that we saw were airline sanctions, both in terms of blocking Belarusian airspace, but more to the point, also stopping the flag carrier Belavia from flying to European destinations. I mean, that's okay, that's fine. And they obviously do have some kind of an impact on the regime. I mean, you know, Belavia, well, it made a loss last year. It made a very small profit in 2019. But, you know, we're talking, I think it was like $29 million off the top of my head. That's not really going to make much of a difference. Now, the point has been made that this might well hurt ordinary Belarusians, but especially Belarusians who are hostile to the regime, by making it harder for them to get out of the country. And to an extent, that is fair enough. Although I do understand that although on the whole, the land borders have been closed with the excuse of COVID-19, that at least some of the border crossings are now open, at least for Belarusian citizens. I could be wrong about that. But when it comes down to it, I mean, these airline sanctions, they were the obvious and immediate moves. And they have a certain value, not least symbolically. And we have to remember that symbolism matters in politics, however much it's not the only thing. But the point is, they can only be just a first step. If that's all or the main thing that comes out, then in fact, I think Lukashenko will feel basically that he got away with it. After all, making Belarus more and more isolated, more and more like, well, let's use the parallel of the North Korea of Europe, as has been sort of thrown around at the moment, in some ways works to his advantage. It is precisely because people feel that they can get out that in some cases it empowers them. It makes them feel that they can be a little bit braver in resisting the regime. So really the question is, where do we move beyond there? And particularly, where does Europe move beyond there? This is a European challenge. And although obviously the United Kingdom will play a role, the United States will play a role, it really is up to the European Union to show leadership here. And again, that's a point I'll come back to in a moment. But that has a particular relevance in the context of the Eastern Partnership. Now, this was set up in 2009 and was meant to be a kind of strategic way of reaching out to various Eastern European non-Russian countries to create some kind of bloc, and that the comfortable fiction was that they were being shepherded towards a more open and democratic society. And in some cases that is true, but Belarus is still a member. Now, the European draft and the European sort of notion of what this partnership was all about is it talks about how, this is a quote, shared values, including democracy, the rule of law, and respect for human rights will be at its core. So here we have a body that claims that respect for human rights is at its core and still has Belarus as a member. I would suggest it's a time to, at the very least, suspend Belarus's membership. Again, is this going to have a big practical impact? No. But the point is, A, again, as I say, symbolic measures matter. And B, so long as you keep something, a country like Belarus, in the Eastern Partnership, then it makes a mockery of the whole and makes Europe look like hypocrites. And this is the problem, and it's as applicable to Belarus as it is for Russia. A point that I've been hammering on is the more we look like hypocrites, the less anyone will pay any attention to the European voice. So that's something that can be done as already. Now, another one of everyone's sort of regular go-tos are economic sanctions. If we look first of all at personal sanctions on specific individuals and officials, what tends to happen is they get slapped with travel bans and asset freezes. Now, that absolutely has its place in certain times and in certain places. I'm not convinced that this is one where it's really going to have much of an impact. I'm not against these sanctions, not at all. I think actually calling out a whole variety of individuals who have done wrong, saying they have done wrong, and basically saying that they are not welcome, actually is a fine and wonderful thing. However, let's not assume, or pretend rather, that the kind of individuals who we really need to target within the Belarusian state had any imminent plans to go holidaying in the south of France, or indeed are likely to have much in the way of property left in the West. Firstly, because if they did, they presumably will have not been so stupid as to leave it there. But secondly, again, look, this is a regime which actually already has been increasingly turning in on itself. Again, the North Koreanization of a regime. So this is, again, simply a symbolic move. So maybe, okay, we move into other kinds of wider economic sanctions. Talk about, you know, addressing the question of, you know, sovereign debt, maybe in terms of certain particular export markets, such as potash or diesel or coal. Well, there may be some value. I mean, the interesting thing actually about coal, for example, is the degree to which Belarus is really used to, for want of a better word, launder coal that has been extracted from the rebel Donbass region and then is moved through Russia, through Belarus, and in some cases is actually sold right back to Ukraine. So that would have an interesting sort of further knock-on. The thing is, look, this is clearly all measures that actually target Belarus as a country and ordinary Belarusians. And what we've seen is, look, authoritarian regimes can survive a certain amount of such pain by basically dumping it on ordinary Belarusians, and in this case also presumably becoming all the more dependent upon Moscow and Moscow's largesse. And again, you know, if you are the kind of sneaky hawk who therefore thinks of this as a way to simply of levelling yet further indirect sanctions upon Moscow, okay, fair enough, it will do that. But if actually the aim is to do something that is going to help Belarus, and indeed more to the point the Belarusian people, it's hard to say that this will actually have any kind of effect. This is a very long-term, slow, grinding tool rather than anything else. Something that I think hasn't been tried, and it's certainly it's going to have a tactical impact, shall we say, is that, you know, we have seen the extent to which, as I said, the KGB, the Belarusian KGB, is involved in all kinds of deeply unpleasant operations against the emigre opposition. Well, then maybe this is a time for a coordinated expulsion of known and suspected KGB officers from Belarusian embassies. There are going to be others who are working under what's called, you know, non-official cover. In other words, they won't have diplomatic immunity, which also means, incidentally, that if you catch them, you can put them in prison. But nonetheless, all the ones who are operating under diplomatic cover, maybe it's time to expel them. And as I said, not by ones and twos, but by whole residenturas, whole stations. And also not by country by country. This is something that really could be, you know, be worth doing on a much, much wider scale. Okay, you might not get total European Union agreement. Hungary remains, as in so many other ways, the irritating standout. But it doesn't have to be done by absolute consensus. This is not something that needs to be, and is not an EU issue necessarily. Countries can just simply agree, just as they did after the Skripal case, that they're going to conduct coordinated expulsions and get on with it. And if they do that, well, first of all, obviously it will put a major dent into the Belarusian state's capacity to exert its malice, but also its surveillance capacities on the people who are trying to bring it down and undermine the regime. And again, it shows a capacity to target something that is rather more serious than just simply sort of, you know, wider political relations. But moving beyond that, there was a very good article by Leonid Rogozin in Politico, yesterday it was. And although I would take issue with a couple of points in terms of how he kind of rolls Russia and Belarus together, and also how dismissive he is about sanctions, which, as I said, do, I think, have a symbolic value. Nonetheless, I mean, he's absolutely spot on when what he says is, again, let me quote, "Far better than sanctions would be an effort to provide people like Protasevich and Navalny with safe havens and opportunities to do their work in the European Union, removing visa hurdles and simplifying residence rules for people who can influence their compatriots back home." Now, this is absolutely spot on, and I think speaks to one of the sort of the crucial things that we have to think about. Look, what is it that we, and I'm saying we, I'm talking about the West as a whole, of course, given that I'm sitting in London, I can't say we for the European Union anymore. What is it that we really want? Now, as I said before, I think that we have to realise that there is a difference in terms of our aspirations and capacities between Belarus and Russia. Not only is the Russian regime more legitimate, and let me just underline, maybe even italicise, perhaps even put in bold, that more legitimate. I'm not saying it is a legitimate regime. But nonetheless, the Russian regime is a lot more legitimate than the Belarusian one. And also, if we're absolutely honest, we need Russia much more. We need to think about what Russia wants, its capacity to do things which can cause a problem for us or do things which can actually make the world a safer place, mean that we have to be rather more circumspect with it than we do with Belarus. So what do we actually want with Belarus? Is it that we want Lukashenko to be a kind of a slightly kinder, nicer, more inclusive kind of dictator? Or actually do we want something more ambitious? Do we want, if we can use these fearsome words, regime change? And I think the honest answer is, look, actually, what we really want is regime change. However, ideally, we'd like the Belarusian people to do it without our help. We'd like to be able to sit back and find it happen. Well, okay, fair enough. But isn't that not a certain amount of moral cowardice involved in that decision? This is not just simply about recognizing the rights of the Belarusians to self-determination, which absolutely needs to be paramount. It is also about the fact that sometimes people need to be helped. And I'm not talking about old-style regime change. Let's be absolutely clear about this. The old style of, you know, invasion, assassination and coup. Firstly, no one's got the stomach for that. Secondly, nothing would be more guaranteed to ensure that Russian tanks would be rolling into Belarus and a Russian proconsular authority established in Minsk than anything like that. And also, it would totally poison our relations with Russia by demonstrating in the minds of not just the paranoid hawks, but many others, that all these things the Kremlin has been saying for years about the West is actually true. And finally, that kind of regime change. I mean, we've seen it's a lot easier to bring down regimes than to put something effective in their place. Belarus, of course, is not Iraq. Belarus is not Afghanistan. But frankly, nor do we want to think that either of those other countries gave us a pretty good playbook for the future. So no, this is totally different. Let's just be honest with ourselves about what it is that we really think matters. And if actually we think it matters that the Belarusian people have a chance to express the same kind of democratic rights that we take for granted, well, maybe that's something we can do to try and help them. And I said, this is the key point I would make. This is about supporting the people of Belarus. And as I said, this is something that first and foremost has to come from the European Union. It's a European issue. And if Europe absolutely cannot lead, I can't help but think it should just accept that it's just a trading and tourism block and be done and stop faffing around and pretending that you have any kind of a greater role in the world system. So what can be done? I mean, beyond, as I say, I mean, there's the negative things which actually also have a positive impact, like kicking out KGB assets and so forth. But more broadly, yeah, let's be much, much more eager. And in this case, when I say let's, yes, I am including the UK. At, for example, providing visas for emigres who have fallen foul of the system. Sometimes it can be full-scale political asylum, but it doesn't necessarily need to reach that kind of a bar. And in particular, I mean, the people I think we really should be reaching out to are, and I mentioned this in the past, defecting security personnel. Police, intelligence officers, military, who basically cannot stomach the situation that's going on there. Let's, by all means, make it easier for them to come here and be able to stay, even just for a while. I'm not saying this is something that is an open-ended thing. I'm not saying that they should be given money to build themselves a house or whatever. This is not the same as some kind of high-level defector whom you have carefully exfiltrated from the country. No, but on the other hand, these are the people who, first of all, will have information that is going to be useful. I mean, if nothing else, I think, you know, the price for a visa is a pretty extensive debrief. What do they know? What can they tell us? But generally, we want to encourage the notion that they are not stuck in a corner. The danger is, and this is something that, for example, we saw with the Berkut, infamous Berkut riot police in Ukraine, that actually, you know, a pretty fair number ended up defecting either directly to the Russians, and you've got Berkutovtsi in the National Guard and so forth, or else actually going into rebel Donbass, precisely because they felt that at best, they faced a trial, and at worst, an impromptu lynching if they remained in Ukraine. So, in a way, we don't want to make people feel that they actually have no alternative but to fight to the end. So, absolutely, let us be much, much more generous in allowing Belarusians to be able to get out of the country if they need to. We should be providing resources to do all kinds of things. I mean, first of all, insofar as, I mean, one can do anything in the Ukrainian, the Belarusian court system, you know, it's worth seeing in terms of what assistance can be provided. But much more than that, again, we really do need to be supporting the free media. The free media, by which I mean Belarusian media, emigre media. This is not a case for, you know, however much I ideally love the BBC World Service or feel vague affection for Voice of America and RFERL and the rest, this is not a case for foreigners to be putting on their own Belarusian broadcasts on a more aggressive level. No, this is about Belarusians speaking to Belarusians and trying to actually penetrate the shroud of outright falsehoods that the state media tries to lay across the country. And whether it's through shortwave radio or more likely the internet, but actually trying to give some genuine, accurate assessment of what's going on. And I would stress that if we are supporting free media, that does not mean propaganda to fight propaganda. That means truth to fight propaganda. I mean, as we've seen, if anything comes out of the whole information campaigns around the late Cold War, it's that in fact, again, outlets like the BBC and RFERL were so much more effective when they stopped just simply trying to basically spread lies and propaganda. Not, well, Did they spread lies? Sometimes they did spread lies. But certainly sort of slanted propaganda, but instead actually just simply presented the Soviet people with reality. So that's something that that we absolutely can and should assist. And with them, the whole infrastructure of, shall we say, émigré political organization and émigré political activism. You know, whether it's in terms of, you know, there's been educational initiatives, there could be cultural initiatives, but anything that basically says, look, Belarusians are Europeans, we support what is going on, and we are willing to encourage people to express their views, their values, their culture in ways that are not controlled by Minsk. Part of that is also thinking about how we interact with what is in effect government in exile of the Coordinating Council, and particularly Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who, as I said, for want of a better word, is the president in exile. I have to say that a lot of the quote-unquote support so far tends to be various European parliaments and leaderships inviting her to talk to them so that they can get a photo op and they can feel terribly virtuous and also get themselves a little bit of a publicity hit. But that's about it. At what point does this simply just become patronising? At what point are your quote-unquote consultations really nothing more than everyone going through exactly the same ritual? So we have to think about this. I mean, look, it's all very well the Lithuanian parliament deciding to recognise the Coordinating Council as the legitimate government of Belarus. But on the other hand, so long as it is Minsk that controls the embassy in Vilnius, are you really recognising this as a government in exile, or are you just simply, again, giving a bit of a warm, fuzzy moment? Now, I don't have a straightforward answer for that. I'm not necessarily saying the embassies should be closed down until representatives of the Coordinating Council can be put in charge of them or something like that. That would be a very big, very ballsy, but really sort of major sort of move. And I'm sure it would have all kinds of international implications of which I am totally and utterly ignorant. But the point is, I think we generally speaking have to move beyond this current performative scale of showing support for Tikhanovskaya and the Coordinating Council through the medium of press conferences. That's not good enough. And we need to move also, and this is a final point, is, I mean, there are already some measures, some initiatives that are directed in this direction. But I would like to see a central system set up, a structure, a centre which can track and record and necessarily investigate the crimes committed by the regime. And by this, I don't just simply mean finding new ways to castigate Lukashenko for being a bad, bad man. He is a bad, bad man with a very unfortunate moustache. Let's just accept that. But on the other hand, I think what's important is the people who are involved in his repressions need to understand that nobody will be forgotten, neither victim nor perpetrator, that there will be investigations that take place now and investigations that will take place in the future when, as is, in my opinion, inevitable, this regime falls, and that there will be some kind of a reckoning. And when I say a reckoning, again, I'm not talking about people being hung from lampposts, but I am talking about genuine legal cases being brought against people who have broken even their own rather permissive laws. So look, bit by bit, that can be gathered. And again, this is something which actually the modern world lends itself to. It's very, very hard to truly keep control over the information of exactly what happens. We've seen this with, you know, police officers' families' details being doxed, in other words, kind of illegally released online or whatever. Well, rather than these rather problematic expressions of it, people should be encouraged to whistleblow to this centre, and bit by bit, a comprehensive picture can be built up of what people did, so they will know that someday, not just at the pearly gates, they will be expected to answer for what they did. Overall, though, this is not about punishing Belarus. I think that is the key thing. It is about supporting Belarus. Belarus as represented by its people rather than a regime. And look, if the regime gets even more muscular, brutal in its treatment of its own people and so forth, then I'm sure that will require yet more of a response. But broadly speaking, what Europe and the West as a whole needs to do is, first of all, be credible. I mean, don't just make grand declarations about what's bad and what needs to change, and then just think somehow magically the world will twist on its axis to make that happen. No, that has to be actually something that then is worked for. Secondly, there has to be a real and specific goal. And just simply say, we would like to see a free and independent Belarus is lovely, but it's meaningless. I mean, it's actually just simply a declaration of faith. It's essentially asking Santa Claus to deliver it. No, there have to be real goals. Goals that accept that Lukashenko will not and cannot change. And there has to be some kind of a strategy, and there the S word, strategy that actually is going to help further that. And again, is going to help further that by accepting that the pressure must come from the Belarusian people. But what is absolutely lacking at the moment is that strategy. At the moment, all we ever really have is response. Shock, horror, oh my God, the Belarusian regime has done something nasty. Who would have thought it? Well, the point is, everybody would have thought it. But each time we seem to be surprised anew by what goes on. Well, let's not be surprised. Let's be strategic. Let's do something about it. But let's realise that whatever we do about it has to be, first of all, plausible. It has to be something that we actually can pull off and will continue to do so. Secondly, it has to be geared towards supporting the Belarusian people. We cannot force change upon them, but we can, where possible, nurture them, assist them into developing the kind of structures which can bring about the change that they want. Thirdly, we have to be very, very careful about the Russia dimension. It's so easy to be stupid about it. I mean, you know, people are saying, oh, we should punish Putin for what's going on in Belarus by blocking the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Well, you know, fair enough. I understand the whole debate about stopping the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. But let's be realistic. If you block Nord Stream 2, actually, you're probably going to see more capacity go through Belarus and thus Lukashenko make more money. So, you know, again, let's just be careful and think through the implications, especially when it comes to Russia. But above all, what tends to happen is something like this happens, and oh my God, it's a shock, it's horror, it's anger, it's sanctions. And then a week passes, a month passes, and it just recedes. It's, you know, consumed by the day-to-day. It's all going to be about COVID. It's going to be about post-COVID economic recovery. It's going to be about trade talks. It's going to be about whatever. It's not going to be about Belarus, unless there is some kind of strategy. So that's what I want to see. I want to see someone, somewhere, ideally within Brussels, coming up with some kind of a strategy. Is that too much to ask? Possibly. And on that downbeat note, thank you very much for listening to, as I said, what was this tremendously incoherent discussion. I mean, I really am shortchanging you. I literally, my notes for this are 6 bullet points on a scrap of paper. So really, I am actually, you know, taking the mickey. But nonetheless, I hope it was of some use and value, and I'll let you get on with your day. Thank you very much for listening. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well. Товарищ